Lake Effect continues now on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. This weekend in southern China, the little-known Tour du Guangxi officially ends the season for World Tour Cycling, a tour that includes better-known races like the Tour de France and the Giro d'Italia.
Except for a brief period in the late 20th century, professional road cycling has never been a popular mainstream sport in the U.S. The exception was the Lance Armstrong era, which ended in infamy amid allegations of doping and admissions of guilt.
Today, there are still many high-level cyclists from the United States competing on World Tour teams. Until recently, Phil Guymon was one of them. But even within the relative obscurity of the sport, he was best known for his love of cookies.
But in addition to cycling, Guymon has another impressive skill, writing. He is the author of three books, the latest of which is a memoir of his two seasons on a World Tour team. For fans of sports books, it portrays a story that's not often told, the story of an athlete who topped out somewhere in between success and failure. The book is called Draft Animals, Living the Pro Cycling Dream Once in a While, and Phil Guymon joins us via Skype from his home in California. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So I say World Tour cycling on the radio, and the chances are good there are people rolling their eyes and thinking doping, cheating, corruption. You are someone who raced and still rides with a tattoo that says clean. How much of writing this book was about calling out the people who are still part of the old culture and shining a light on the people like you who lived your career without performance enhancements?
I wasn't trying to write like, I don't know, the cycling, the sort of the story in my sport has kind of been the doping tell-all in the last 10 years, sort of since the Lance era. I came in when that was over. No one ever offered me drugs. Like we sort of saw my people of my generation, my first year was like Lance's last. There was very little overlap. And the people who kind of came in when I did, all we saw was just like the mess of it. From sponsors running away to people, the scandals coming out from things that happened 5 years before. And then I was always sort of good enough that I never had to turn this stuff down. It wasn't part of my world when I was coming up, but I was a victim of it. I was a victim of the people who kind of came before and the people who grew the sport that made it unsustainable. I got a clean tattoo. It's a bar of soap, kind of Fight Club-ish on my bicep. So it's sort of oriented when I win a race and you kind of post up in glory, that you can see it, front and center there. But the book was sort of what it's like to kind of start racing in the shadow of all that and to try to be your best self when things are crumbling down around you.
Right. You say, I mean, you know, you say in a couple of places, you understand why people might succumb to the pressure and decide to cheat. What was it about your makeup that made you, you know, resist what other people couldn't?
I don't know. I think I sort of think back to when I first started racing. You know, it was in college. It was sort of a different start to most of the World Tour people, most of the guys who make it to the top. They're racing at 12, they're national champions at 15. I didn't start racing until I was 18. I was in college and I got through all that. And sort of the people around me there were very, you know, anti-doping kind of, it was very far from the atmosphere. Collegiate racing was more about like getting drinks after the race and hanging out with your buddies and loading into a van, than the whole, you know, for performance sort of angle. I see a big difference in if the world of the doping era where you're on a bus and, you know, Lance Armstrong is passing you a needle, versus to like, I understand why that guy would do it. Cause I can imagine that would feel. You work your way up this ladder. It's many years, it's training is hard. And then this seems to be the next step. Like, I guess I get that. The era I was in, like to get drugs, I'd have had to really work hard to find it. You'd have had to, you know, order it from China on the internet and inject it yourself somewhere. Like it was super different by then. But I do get sort of when as I was on the way down, as I was sort of like this close to the top. You know, I'm on the long list for the Olympics and I'm on the long list for some of the biggest races in the world. And if I was, you know, 10 watts better, that would have been tremendous. And that's not much. And I sort of see like when you get to that difference, when you get that desperate, you know, if I wasn't like raised upper middle class and college educated and haven't had other things going on, I get it.
You write briefly about Chris Froome, and I'm doing this interview under the assumption that many of our listeners might not be up to speed on World Tour cycling, but Chris Froome burst onto the scene a few years ago, and he's now at the top of the sport. He's won four Tours de France, and this year he won the Vuelta, the Tour of Spain, and yet in the post-Armstrong era, many have really, you know, very publicly aired their suspicions that he's doping or somehow cheating. Do you think, is that the legacy of Lance Armstrong, that no one gets to be the best at the sport anymore?
I think that's exactly it. I think from Lance, from that whole mess, that's what we have to clean up, is that the story of cycling isn't, you know, who's the best or who works the hardest. And I don't know Froome personally, but I do know people who've talked about, like, just what an animal he is and how hard he works and double digits. I mean, the thing is we all work hard, and then if for someone I know on his team to be like, oh no, Chris works a notch harder than the rest of us. That sort of means a lot, and it's kind of hard to grasp knowing what it takes to get to the top level in any sport. But yeah, I think the story of in cycling became, what are they on? Who's, you know, what is he getting away with? When was he clean, and when did he stop being dirty? And that whole, and people like to debate that. I always say, like NBA or like basketball fans want to compare LeBron to Jordan. Like, that's the conversation around cycling. From just how bad it was all those years, and I don't know how they get away from that, and I sure don't miss it. So yeah, just by virtue of being the best at a bike race, you're suspicious. And I wasn't even any good. I raced in Europe, and then I kind of came back to the minor leagues for a year. I came back to the racing in the States, and there were a couple of races where I just had like world class fitness in my legs, and I was killing everybody. And people, and I got accusations, and I was like, man, I can name 100 guys who would kill me. You guys just like, but that's the world. And it's definitely like a tough thing. I don't know how the sport can really overcome it other than just years of clean. And it's not necessarily going in that direction. There's still enough scandal for people to talk about.
Okay, so let me ask you a nerdy cycling question, if I can. You rode Paris-Roubaix in 2016. And for people who don't know it, this is a one-day super long race over dozens of stretches of cobblestones and huge crowds along the route. Can you describe, I mean, for people who have only been to a cycle race in this country, can you describe the intensity of an experience like that?
Roubaix, it's that's Belgium's Super Bowl. They prepare for it all year. They come out and they've got their coolers, and there's sort of, it's roads all through Belgium. It's mostly flat. Somehow it usually rains. The year I did it, it didn't. And they've got the meat of the race is in these cobble sectors, it's called. And they're all sort of like labeled, and certain sectors, all this year we'll add this sector this year. And it's just, the cobblestones are just horrible. Like, you can't ride a bike on them, but that's the race. So there's a war of positioning to get to the front, so you're not stuck behind the inevitable crashes or the flat tires or whatever. And then it's just like the big Belgian kind of style racing of bumping shoulders and sprinting, and a very physical sort of positioning kind of race. And people come out. I'm not sure. There's probably a million people on course, and they have ways to go from this sector to that sector and try to catch the whole race. It's a big deal over there. It's super strange coming from the U.S. where you're at best in the way of traffic to that, where it's, you know, there are autographs and all that crazy stuff.
Right. There's this phenomenon that you and other cyclists describe as pedophiles, the rabid fans in places like Belgium. And what are those encounters like for a pro rider?
Well, it's weird because, like, as a pro cyclist, I don't know, I came up here where pro cycling is such a fringe sport that you're completely anonymous. And I don't think I get recognized never in public. Like, maybe on the bike, if I'm wearing my team clothes, someone will recognize me on the, but it's so, and over there, you're Johnny Depp. You have to, like, when you're walking, you're staring at the ground, and they will harass you for souvenirs. It's a strange, and that's sort of what's different about, I guess the way I felt it as cycling is, there's things that you're a fan of and you kind of admire them. And then cycling, it's still sort of a low end sport where they want something from you and they feel like they can take it. So they take your water bottles, they want your jersey, they want your hat, they want your gloves. I don't know how that happened, but it's a weird thing where they felt like crows a lot. And that's just something that you get used to it real quickly. Like if you finish a race and you're not going to make it from the finish line to the bus with your water bottles. So you just chug them and you throw them at people, because otherwise somebody's just going to tackle you for them. Like it's and they all have collections of water bottles. It's super bizarre. It's hard to explain my sport after 10 years. And it's the more I'm out, the just the weirder it is.
Well, and maybe this question sounds heavier than I'd like, but do you think there's ultimately some value in it being you who lived this life, since you are one of the few who could bear witness to it in this way, given what a I'll say it, great writer you are?
Thank you. I think, yeah, I sort of, and I don't know, every year as I was racing, I sort of was like, this is probably going to be the last year, because this is never, like, I was never getting paid enough that it made sense. And I was always like right on the verge of not having a job at all. And sort of what I came to peace to going into my last couple of years is like, okay, I'm not going to win the bike race, but I'm the best guy who's going to be in the bike race and can tell you about it. And I think that's the only, if there's anything I was put on this world to do, just looking at my set of skills and my circumstances, it would have to be that. So I'm just going to have to do the best I can there. And I think it's worth it. I think I was able to sort of paint a picture of what it's like to be in the World Tour that folks will be interested in.
There are plenty of first-person ghost-written books by cyclists out there, but first of all, they all kind of follow the same trajectory. It's someone who has gone on to be, you know, at the very top of their sport, and you know, it seems like the story you're telling is much more representative of what the rest of the peloton is going through.
Right, I would have loved it if my story ended that way. but then, yeah, I would have hired a ghostwriter and I'd be in a palace somewhere. I think it's true. I think that, yeah, the guys, man, when you get to the top of, and I wonder what this is like in other sports, but as I sort of got up there in, and I was with the best riders in the world, some of my teammates and my finger quotes peers. The guys I was hanging out with were the very top, and I realized like that it's only really like the rest of us are chasing this thing that it's only really working for like 40 dudes. Like it's very, very small people are actually living the life that makes sense and able to like they know what they're doing next week. And they're able to like have, you know, a balanced existence. So you sort of see that and think like, yeah, there's a story to be told of the rest of us and what it's actually like that's probably wouldn't be covered in Mark Cavendish's or Chris Froome's book.
What do you think of the trajectory of the sport in the U.S.? I mean, does it take a clean version of Lance Armstrong? I mean, obviously not Lance himself at this point, but to get cycling back onto the radar of Americans again on a larger scale?
I don't know. I feel like Lance definitely created a bubble. His story was so good, the whole cancer thing. He was so good as far as just, you know, he was able to sort of competently host SNL. Like athletes, like you didn't roll your eyes too much. He did it okay. But yeah, when that bubble burst, I think a lot of people felt betrayed and now like they roll their eyes at the whole sport, and you know, there's HBO mockumentaries about how silly the doping is. There's one mockumentary. I don't really know what can fix it. I don't think cycling is ever meant to be mainstream. I think it's sort of like we're the guys in the way in the bike lane, you know. That's or hopefully in the bike lane. We're the guys who wish there was a bike lane, and until then you honk at us, and that's kind of the thing. And I think like in the U.S. it's just going to sort of be that. And part of me like. I liked it that way when I was kind of coming up in the American League, which I sort of compare to the minor leagues for cycling. Like everyone who was on my team, like they're getting paid $6,000 to $45,000 a year, and they're on the road all year, and you just don't do it unless you love it.
I wanted to ask you one more question that's a little maybe off topic, but you lived for quite a while in Girona during the time this book takes place. Are you in touch with people who are still there now during the independence movements and the violence that's going on in Catalonia?
A large fraction, for some reason, well, actually, we can blame this on Lance, too. This is what Lance did. For some reason, a large fraction of the world tour, American-speaking guy at the top level, kind of clustered in this little town an hour and a half outside of Barcelona, which it's just amazing roads. And initially, they went there because they were in France, and France made it actually illegal to dope, whereas just one, you get banned from sport, but other, you could actually go to prison. So they all ran to Spain, and this little town sort of became the hub for English-speaking cyclists, and a bunch of teams sort of set up warehouses there and infrastructure, and that became the spot. And so I lived there for two summers, and a lot of my friends and network and former teammates and buddies are still there. It's been strange to – it's weird. It's not reported much. It's sort of – it's a small corner of a small country, I guess. But I look at it, lots of apartment windows there have the flag coming out of it, and there were a lot of protests and parades, and it was definitely something that was kind of always bubbling, and now to sort of see it come to the surface. And I still don't, I've been reading a lot. It's hard to understand either side. I just was reading a thing in the New York Times about it and trying to sort of figure out what's going on. But it looks tough. Like, I guess the New York Times opinion was that they shouldn't be trying to be independent because their things are good, and what's their problem? And the whole vote was kind of a sham that then the Spanish police decided to enforce and go after and close down in a way that now it's really strengthened the independence movement. So everybody's wrong on all sides as politics goes, I guess.
Well, that's a lousy way to end this. But So let me ask you, so we won't end it this way.
You saved the tough question for the end.
Talk about cookies. Why did cookies become such a big thing for you?
Okay, that's a good way to end it. So the cookie thing is, it's really funny. So I have this cookie-themed bike ride in Malibu. And the idea, I don't really know how it happened, but at some point I was writing a blog for Bicycling Magazine, and I had a bad race, and at the end I was kind of like, I got home and I got there in time that this place was still open. I got this cookie I liked a lot. I'm a big fan of cookies, and I was like, at this point I was an amateur, like I had no Twitter followers, no one knew who the heck I was, other than I had a little blog on a cycling website. Next race I went to, someone brought me a cookie. They're like, hey, I want you to try this. I read your thing. I saw you like cookies. And then I posted a little picture about it somewhere, or maybe I mentioned that next blog. And gradually, that was 2008. And since then, 7 years later, the team rolls up at the Tour of California, and there's just like 10 people lined outside where the bus is going to park with plates of cookies with my name on them and go fill Cookie Monster signs. And I'm like disproportionately – I had fans far out of proportion to my abilities and results because of the cookie thing. I think the hardest I ever laughed was I pulled up to one of those races and the stage in Pasadena or something, which is sort of almost hometown for me now. And there's all these cookies for me, and all my teammates are kind of like, these guys are famous and national champions and like so much better than me. Like, I bring them bottles. That was my job. That was the peak of my existence, was like go back to the car and get these guys jackets or bottles. And they're like, one guy, Ben King from Virginia, was like, Phil, I don't get it. Doesn't everybody like cookies? And I've never laughed harder in my life. just stumbled over the bus. I was like, that's true.
Well, Phil Guymon, it's a great read, and I really appreciated a chance to get to speak with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Hope we can talk again.
Yeah, sounds good.
How can it make you sad, Cookie Monster?
Phil Guymon is a former professional road cyclist. His new memoir is called Draft Animals, Living the Pro Cycling Dream Once in a While. And he joined us via Skype from California. You can find a link to more, including his podcast and series of YouTube videos, at wuwm.com.